Last night I was over at my sister-in-law's house. She just moved to Kansas City recently, and we had a family dinner over at her house. All of my wife's brothers were there and their children, and sat around the table having a good meal. And she has this amazing table in her dining room. She had it specially made. It's about 3.5 feet wide, and it's about 8 feet long. It's just a monster of a table. She had it made out of old reclaimed lumber. So it has this rough, almost an old farmhouse look to it. It's this gray wood, and it's a beautiful table. The legs on it are these massive 4x4 pylons that hold this heavy table up. As we sat there last night, you can't help but notice that one of the legs is black and charred. You see, about 1.5 years ago, my sister-in-law was living in Minneapolis, and this table is the centerpiece of her home. Not only does she have dinners at it, but she works on it quite often because it's such a big space. She can put everything out. She was working on the table one day, and she had to leave her home to go to a meeting, and she'd left some incense burning on the corner of the table. And the incense fell into a trash can on the floor, and it set the papers in the trash can on fire. And the trash can actually burned to ash. It burned the trash can to nothing. It burned a trash can-sized hole in the hardwood floor underneath it. And the flames climbed up the leg of this table and then died out. And I'm not sure why. This table is old, dry wood. It should have gone up like kindling. I'm not sure why it didn't. She's not sure why it didn't. The table should have caught fire. It should have caught the room on fire. The house should have burned down. That didn't happen. They had smoke damage, but other than the hole in the floor that they had to patch, the only damage that was really left was this one charred leg. And I asked her, I said, why don't you fix that? And she goes, that's a reminder to me to make sure I put the incense out. Fire is a contemptuous companion on our journey of life. We like fire when it's under control. It warms us. It gives us light. I have a fire pit on my patio that I built. And we love to build a small fire in that. And everybody sits around the fire. We have good conversation. We eat food. We roast marshmallows and make s'mores. But just over here, I have my garden hose ready to go. Because I'm aware the fire's fine inside the pit. But if that animal gets out of its cage, I need to be able to put it down quickly. Just recently, again, we saw the devastating effects of forest fires in the American West. Millions of acres burned, houses destroyed, lives lost. It's a stark reminder of the power and possibility of fire. So it's eye-opening that the author of the book of James chose fire as the analogy for our tongue. So also the tongue is a small member, yet it boasts of great exploits. How great a forest is set ablaze by a small fire, and the tongue is a fire. The tongue is placed among our members as a world of iniquity. It stains the whole body, sets on fire the cycle of nature, and is itself set on fire by hell. How great a forest is set ablaze by a small fire. This summer there were several wildfires out in California. One of them was called the Carr Fire, C-A-R-R. It was devastating. It was a huge fire. Does anybody remember what started it? What started that fire, Lucy? It was a flat tire. Guy had a flat tire, and as he was driving down the road, the rim struck the asphalt and threw sparks on the dry grass on the shoulder. That fire consumed 145,000 acres and killed 7 people. And it started because a guy got a flat tire. This is what James is referring to. Our words, the things that we say to each other every day, They can inadvertently spark a fire in someone's life. Our words, our tongues have that type of destructive power. So James warns us to bridle ourselves, to keep our tongues in check, because they could do irreparable harm. For every species of beast and bird, of reptile and sea creature can be tamed and has been tamed, but no one can tame the tongue. A restless evil full of deadly poison. When I was getting ready for the sabbatical a couple years ago, we applied for a grant from the Lilly Foundation. And for that, I had to write a proposal of what I would do on my sabbatical. And what I proposed was that I wanted to study the spoken word more. Because I do this on a regular basis. I speak, I talk, I use words in what I do. And I wanted to better understand the power that they hold, because I see this power. Because I experience this. I want to know more about it. So that was my idea, that I would go and I would hear other great speakers. I would listen to how they use words to shape ideas. The idea was to further this study during the sabbatical. How our words hold power. When I sit down to write my sermon each week, I am constantly reminding myself that I need to pick the right words for what I'm trying to say. This is not happenstance or hodgepodge. I select words specifically for their emotion, for their impact, for their power. I did a wedding yesterday up in Platte City. It was a nice wedding. It was a nice young couple. Cody and Brittany Wheatley is their name. You should keep them in your prayers as well. Today is marriage day two. And there's no party today, so, you know. I got done doing the wedding, and it was at this place called 1890. It's an old farmhouse that's been it's beautiful. It's been all redone. We went back inside the farmhouse. The wedding was outside. We went back inside to sign the marriage license and stuff like that. The maid of honor came up to me, and I had not spoken two words to this woman yet, and she came up to me and she said, "Did you write that?" And I said, "Did I write what, the wedding?" And she's like, "Yeah." And I was like, well yes, I did, yeah. I said, in conjunction, I said, I talked with Cody and Brittany and got their ideas and heard their story and incorporated that into it. I said, much of it was the words they gave me, but yeah. I said, yeah, that's what I do, I write it. She's like, "That was amazing." I was like, "Oh, well, thank you. Great. I'm glad you liked it." She's like, "I got married a year and a half ago, and it was awful." I'm not sure what that's a criticism of, so okay. But it was just another reminder that I don't even realize sometimes we put words out there and people hear them and they might be touched in some way by them. They might be moved in some way by them. They might be impacted in some way by them. I was not saying those words yesterday for the maid of honor. I was saying them for the bride and groom. That's who they were written for. That's who I was talking to. But it was this other person who heard them and who said, "Wow, that was really, really something." That is the powers that words have. They can touch people. They can impact. They can change. The words that we say to one another, to family and friends, to strangers, they come out of our mouth with force and fury. And we have to know that. We must be aware of that. We have to be cognizant of that. Because when we aren't, when we flippantly spew words out, unmindful of their power, we risk a spark that can set the forest ablaze. How many times in my life have I let words out that hurt someone, that damaged someone, that caused harm, that sparked hatred and meanness? How many times have I heard the words leaving my mouth and my brain has said, "Oh, I wish you hadn't said that." My words matter. Your words matter. And far too often, I have simply let them spill out like sparks from a welder landing on the dry grass. And even worse, how many times did I know that my words would cause hurt and I let them out anyway? How many times did I vomit forth flame in the hopes that I would start a fire? How many times have I recklessly wielded this power that God has blessed me with in a hateful and damaging way? Far too often. It's really interesting that the lectionary today paired these two scriptures together. They pair the scripture from James where he's talking about the tongue is a fire that can set the forest ablaze. And then it turns and it gives us this scripture from Mark where Jesus is walking with the disciples and he says, "Who do people say that I am?" And they said, "Well, some people say you're John the Baptist, some people say you're Elijah." And he stops them and he says, "But who do you say that I am?" It's a poignant question. And Peter answers, "You are the Messiah." 2,000 years later, we call ourselves the disciples of Christ. We stand in that same position. Jesus continues to ask that question, "Who do you say that I am?" And we must respond. Far too often, our response far too often, this response is answered in our quiet, secure compounds of faith that we have erected. We answer boldly when asked, "Here, you are the Messiah," but then we walk out these doors into a world that is hungry for the bread of life, that is thirsty for the cup, and all too often, we become mute. We go out into the world directed by Jesus to go out and make disciples. We burst from these doors in time to make it to the buffet, in time to get kickoff, in time to see the first pitch. But somehow we lose our words. Here we shout, "You are the Messiah." And there we mumble something incoherently, silently, quietly. It's not that we don't have words. Oh, we have words. Ask me to complain about something. I've got words. I'm happy to share them with you. I spent 5 minutes yesterday complaining to a complete stranger about the fact that my phone wouldn't work because I have Sprint and they don't offer service in Kansas City. 5 minutes. Didn't know her name. We talked about the fact that cell phones stink. 5 minutes. Didn't offer one word about Jesus as the Messiah. Even though we are warned of the destructive power of our tongue, we shoot forth sparks like a 4th of July party favor when we want to gossip or gripe, when we want to complain, when we want to bemoan. We can find a plethora of words for our using. We become quite loquacious, quite garrulous, rather verbose, given the chance to moan and complain and gossip. Oh, I'm a chatty Cathy. But seeing someone who might need the grace of Christ in their life, who might be hungry for the bread of life, and all of a sudden our lips are sealed. No one can tame the tongue, a restless evil full of deadly poison. With it we bless the Lord and Father, and with it we curse those made in the likeness of God. From the same mouth come blessing and cursing. This ought not be so. We can't put both out there. Our words are going to start a fire today of some kind. Which fire will they start? Will we set aflame someone's passion to find Jesus the Christ, to seek Christ's presence in their life, to follow God in their everyday, to seek out that bread of life that we have found? Or will we burn someone's life to ash with disparaging words of hatred? Will we send sparks that char emotions and kindle resentment? When we run through the forest, will it be with sparklers dangling from our hands, catching the dry grass aflame with reckless abandon? It is our choice. We choose which fire starter we will be. We're going to start a fire today. Will it be a warm fire that draws someone closer to God, that brings them in? Or will it be a damaging blaze that destroys everything it touches, leaving black, crumbling destruction in its path? What words will you put out there today? Will they be complaints and gossip that leave burn scars on lives, or will they be words that fill someone with the warmth of God who loves us, the warmth of a God who saves us, the warmth of a God that sets us free? A decade ago now, I was the associate pastor in Kearney at the Christian church there, and whenever the senior pastor was gone, I would lead worship, and I was doing the words at the table one day, and I thought I'd be different. I made an analogy. There's a movie called Napoleon Dynamite. It's an old movie, 15 years ago, I think. There's a scene in it. It's about this kid in high school, Napoleon, and he's in the lunchroom one day, and he gets tater tots, and he loves tater tots. So he takes tater tots and he puts them in his pocket. And later in class, he's sneaking out a tater tot. And the kid across the aisle sees it. He says, "Hey, let me have some of your tater tots." Napoleon says, "No." So the kid smushes the tater tots in his pocket. And I use that analogy and I said, you know, tater tots are a lot like grace. We have grace. We've come here and we're taking some grace from this table. We put it in our pocket. And I'm going to go out today, and when I need it, I'm going to pull a little piece of that grace out. I'm going to eat it. And someone else is going to see that, and they're going to be like, "Hey, can I have some of that grace?" And we have to decide whether we're going to share our tater tots or not, right? It was a silly analogy. In all reality, it was. I was being cute, you know, if I'm being honest. 2 years after that, a gentleman in church. He didn't come every week. He came sporadically, but he had been there that day. 2 years after that service, he came up to me one day and he said, "I just want you to know." He said, "Every day when I leave the house," he goes, "I think to myself, who am I going to share my tater tots with today?" This silly little analogy that I came up with, the communion table, tater tots, haha. And yet those words touched him somewhere. Somehow tater tots was the words he needed to hear. And every day when he goes out, he thinks about, how can I share my grace with others? Our words have power. There's going to be a fire today. Which one is it going to be?